Welcome to Recalculating Small Business.
Dan, our next guest is Nicholas Daniel Richards. He is co-founder of Ship Hero, and what his company can mean to any small business is well worth listening to. Nicholas, welcome to the program.
Hello, how's it going?
Well, you're from New Zealand. You're the co-founder of the company. I love the title of it, Ship Hero. So tell us a little bit about what your company does, how it does it, and why it could really help small business.
All right. Pretty straightforward question. So basically, we're a software platform. We've created a software platform that lives in the cloud that allows a company that sells products online, like an e-commerce company, to manage their inventory across their sales channels, and then when they get orders, to be able to fulfill those orders, generate the shipping label, ship those orders out, and more importantly, do that accurately and on time so your customers get their orders when they ordered them and they're happy, so you have happy customers.
Well, that's a short explanation, and we're going to go into detail because I really feel your company will benefit small business and make them a little bit more competitive against the Amazons of this world.
That's a big thing. I mean, a lot of the businesses that we deal with are those. It's you've started the business. And I think a lot of people that are starting businesses, the thing that you focus on initially is you've got to get your business off the ground. A lot of people are more prepared to go through the pain of getting a business off the ground than they are dealing with the unexpected success. So we definitely have a lot of customers that come to us, and their pain is not so much the fact that they're getting off the ground. It's, oh, we've got this product and we're selling it and we have lots of customers and we're doing well, but we were totally unprepared for that. And it turns out that all the things that you need to do to deliver a great customer experience when you're scaling, that's really the struggle of a business. So, we get that a lot.
And your website?
It's ShipHero.com. I know the way I say it sounds like it's some lawyer, but it's basically ship and hero combined. That's ShipHero.com.
So spell it out for our radio audience.
Absolutely, it's ShipHero.com, and I know that I say H weird. That's what happens when you're British. Yeah.
Well, I know you're from New Zealand, and you know it's outside of the United States my favorite country, so I'm kind of biased.
I'm going to have to disappoint you, Don, because I'm actually from the UK. All I do is drink tea. That's basically all I do. So yeah.
Well, you're my third favorite country, but somehow or other I got the impression you. But is your company from New Zealand, or have I just been out of the ballpark totally?
No, we started the company in New York. I'm originally from the UK and came over in, my gosh, and I'm having to go back through multiple calendars. But I came over in 98, and it was because of the internet and building web software. So I've been over here for long enough to be very familiar with all the things that are America, but yeah, we're based in New York.
Well, your English accent is definitely an advantage at any point. Dan, after take all the egg off my face, I turn it over to you.
Thank you. Who is your typical customer today?
So we have. I would say the typical customer is they're using Shopify, BigCommerce. They may be selling on Amazon, and maybe fulfilling through Amazon FBA. And what they're essentially dealing with as a business is they're hitting that point where they're going beyond the 30 orders per day. So once you start going beyond 30 orders per day, those things that may have been a nuisance or an irritant in your operation, such as, oh, okay, we missed that order today, we'll do it tomorrow, or oh, we oversold something because we didn't actually have the inventory that we thought we had, and we've sold that, we can call that one customer up, that was maybe happening once or twice a week. Those things, once you start hitting 30 orders a day, are actually becoming operationally a big problem. So we have a lot of customers that come to us that are hitting that point, they're scaling, and they really need something that they need a platform to solve some very basic struggles. Maybe it's just inventory management or the ability to print a shipping label and ship orders out, but they're quickly finding themselves looking for something that can grow with their business. So they don't want to get something that solves a problem now and then to be faced with, oh, we're going to have to replace this in 6 months. They really want something that can grow with them. So a lot of the businesses that we deal with, the majority are smaller businesses seeing growth and need to scale and grow.
So would you say that you're primarily an e-commerce business?
Yeah. And that's actually a good point. That's a good clarification. So the businesses are e-commerce. We are seeing more businesses now that may have a mixture. So they're obviously going across multiple digital channels, such as they may be selling on Amazon. More seem to be going onto the Walmart marketplace as Walmart opens up and becomes a bit more aggressive. They'll have their own sales channel, obviously a Shopify store, for example. And then they may do, they may have just opened a brick and mortar, or they're combining brick and mortar and they have a point of sale. And we do have some customers as well that will combine all of that with flash sales, you know, whether they'll open up a pop-up store or be part of a road show or a convention, and they'll actually sell product there. So that, you know, from a customer perspective, e-commerce is at the core of it. But it's interesting to see this curve of how companies really were struggling to be effective online. And those companies that are really effective online, how they're trying to get more effective offline as well, which is interesting.
You raise a very interesting point, because JCPenney announced over the weekend they're closing more stores. Sears is closing stores. There are a lot of the boutique private or boutique label stores are having difficulty, and they're closing. Toys R Us announced on Friday they're closing all of their stores in the United States.
Yeah, shocking. Putting
30-some thousand people out of work. So it would seem that the challenges in brick and mortar got to be a lot higher than the challenges in web-based marketing.
I mean, definitely, if you're a business that has, you know, you're a JCPenney or a Macy's, I mean, they're going to have their own issues as far as the amount of footprint they have. From a brick and mortar perspective, cost, their ability to compete with, say, Amazon, which essentially, whether you're a small business or a Walmart, Amazon is who you're competing against. I think from our experience, you know, we're obsessed at Shipiro. We're obsessed in everything that happens after an order is placed by a customer, and ultimately how that item ends up in a customer's hands. I think one of the struggles that larger businesses have, and we do have larger customers that come to us, it's not just the small ones, they're dealing with what we call the technical debt of enterprise software. So you have this enterprise software that maybe you had initially developed a decade or a few decades ago in the case of some of these very large companies, and they cannot they just can't get the speed. They can't create the personalized experience or set the economies of scale in terms of how they can operate to compete against Amazon, because they're dealing with lots of overhead and a technology platform that probably is quite old and gets in the way. So we do see companies that come to us that have been around for a lot longer than we have. We've only been around for 5.5 years, and they have substantial brick-and-mortar presence. And what they're doing is they're basically saying, let's get rid of the old model of how we used to have the software that we would spend millions of dollars on. How can we get fast and nimble? And they're coming to us. And it's something to be able to go into these companies and be able to advise and, you know, put a solution in place that helps a company that's shipping out tens of thousands of orders per day, has hundreds of stores. But we do have that.
Do you see, however, Nicholas, do you see big box stores who are trying to develop a real online presence, or are they just still playing at it?
So I think, and I've got an interesting perspective on this. So one of the reasons why we started Shapiro was, I guess, twofold. So Aaron Rubin, who it was myself and Aaron that started Shapiro. He was looking at it from a operational perspective. How can you be operationally much more efficient? How can you compete with, say, Amazon that's invested hundreds of millions of dollars in distribution centers and infrastructure to be able to make tremendous profit from being able to essentially fulfill an order within 30 minutes, an hour of it being received and having it shipped out the same day. So how do you achieve that operational efficiency? And from my perspective, I was looking at it from customer experience. And I think you've had for a number of years now, you've had some leading brands that are trying to fit a customer experience journey. And I think this is where some brands get it right and are getting there, and then some brands are completely failing at this. So if you go into a store, you're going into a store because it's either a sale or it's convenience. If you're buying on Amazon, and I buy a tremendous amount of stuff on Amazon, I'm buying it because I don't need to physically go somewhere and deal with, you know, you've got to park, you've got to get into the store, you've got to find the thing, and then you've got to buy it, and then you've got to get back in the car, and you've got to go, you know, that's sort of a pain. So there's friction in that user experience. But if you have a user experience where you're going somewhere, it's more of a, and you'll see some brands that do this, you're going into, I think Coach is a good example, Burberry is a good example. You'll see this a lot more on the luxury brands, maybe not so much on the box stores. But you're going in and you're getting an experience. So it's part of the reason why you like that brand, or maybe you're getting advice in terms of what works for your wardrobe, or, you know, what the product is that you should buy based upon your requirements, which goes beyond the utility of going onto an Amazon. So I think where the disconnect is for a lot of brands, especially those that are struggling with the in-store experience, is how they can serve a customer both digitally and in-store and bring that experience together. It's, you know, the user journeys get complicated, but they're connected. So you could have someone that may buy online and may buy on Amazon, but that's still a potential consumer for you in your store, as long as your in-store experience is relevant to them. And I think that's what, you know, if you're just going straight on the we're going to compete against Amazon and try and sell as cheap and beat Amazon at their own game, I think that's a pretty difficult proposition. But if you're going to approach consumers and say, hey, you know, our in-store experience offers something that you may not be able to get online from an experience perspective, or maybe there's product or a way to obtain a product which you couldn't do online. And I think apparel is sort of a typical example of that, the fit and finish of apparel. Then the in-store experience can be much better.
Yeah. I have one more question, then I'll turn it back over to Don. Nicholas, we had a couple of people on our show last week who started out as e-commerce and have been successful, tens of millions of dollars. And part of their business model was to find distribution outlets in addition to selling their product on their own website. And several of them offer their product through Amazon, and but they also have a competing website, and now they're beginning to think about opening bricks and mortar operations.
Yep.
And I'm fascinated that that the people who started out on the web, a number of them that we've interviewed over the last year or so, are successful in their venture on the web, are now looking at ultimate distribution. So what I'm wondering is, if you're dealing with a new customer today, are they trying to do their own web presence, or are they trying to do it, trying to launch a business with Amazon? What are they trying to do today, Nicholas?
They're typically, we see it's they're trying to grow. And a lot of them are thinking multi-channel. And I guess it depends on the product as well. So if you're, I do see this a lot. If it's a product that's, maybe it's a new product, it's a new brand, and the target audience is a younger audience, younger demographics and younger consumers are more interested in the experience. More so than just the material gain. So we see a lot of customers that come to us that are, they've got something, it's working, and now what they have to do is they've gone beyond the complexity of starting the business, which is no easy undertaking. Now they're dealing with, we have demand. Now we need to be able to deliver that customer experience, and we need to be able to do that at scale. So if we need to be able to deliver a customer experience in store, and you know, on that note, on the brick and mortar, I think Warby Parker is a fantastic example there. You're seeing a purely digital company go to brick and mortar, and they don't even sell product in their brick and mortar. Their brick and mortar is essentially you go in to experience their product, but you still buy it online. So we're seeing more of that. We're seeing companies that are truly going multi-channel. They will sell on Amazon because there's a marketplace, and that's a great way to get new customers. And then they'll have their own channel, which maybe is you can get other products there that you wouldn't be able to get in the marketplace. And then you'll have the more physical experience that is a way for your consumers to be able to experience or become aware of your brand with the ultimate goal of driving those sales online where you're most efficient. And, you know, we deal with a lot of that in terms of those companies trying to scale.
Okay, Don, back to you.
Okay. I'm going to go back a little bit and kind of clarify basically, your system helps people ship their product more efficiently and at less cost. Would that be some of
that's right.
How to do it?
Yeah, because essentially what we're doing is we're, instead of the use of, a smaller company, they're going to use spreadsheets and different apps. What we're doing is, we have one platform that has a lot of intelligence and flexibility in terms of how you can configure it and how it will work. And it will basically take all of those decision points out of the process and all of those opportunities to make mistakes. So a common thing that we have is people that will, you know, be working in a warehouse. They have to fulfill an order, and maybe the order has three line items. What will happen is the order may not be prioritized enough, and maybe it's late by the time it gets to a customer, which is not a great experience, or there's a wrong or missing item that's in the box when the customer gets it. And what we found is, and obviously it's built into our software, what we found is just the simple use of barcode scanning, which is not a complicated thing, the simple use of barcode scanning will massively eliminate a lot of errors. So we see, you know, customers that come to us, and maybe they have a 10% error rate, which we think is exceptionally high. You know, once they've implemented Shapiro, and once they have just implemented the barcode scanning, which basically will tell you if you've not picked the right item or not, and will tell you if you've packed the order correctly. Just by doing that, they can reduce it from, say, 10% of their orders having error to less than 0.2%, which is an incredible turnaround with some really simple stuff.
Well, I agree with that. Just today, the New York Times featured an article how FedEx was introducing its first robot pickers into a facility. And obviously that's going to be part of the future. Are you helping your client, the clients get to that point, or what's your take on what's happening?
So definitely automation is something that we're mindful of. And I think, so we serve both the individual brands. Those are companies that are fulfilling and shipping their own orders to their own customers. And then we also serve 3PLs, the outsourced fulfillment providers that will be doing the fulfillment and the inventory management for lots of other brands, their customers. And what we find is there is exploration for automation. We're doing a lot of automation right now via software that is decision making and forecasting. But trying to get that mix of human and robotic automation in a facility, in a distribution center, is definitely something that's on the roadmap. We can see that it's coming. It's just trying to figure out, and we do a lot of experimentation. We do R&D in terms of what would be the right application of it. I think one of the challenges you run into once you start introducing machinery and some forms of automation is obviously the safety factor, how those systems will exist with humans in the mix as well. And what we find is, you know, for our customers, I think the highest daily volume that I've seen from one of our customers, about 25,000 orders in a day that they ship. They are doing that purely from a human perspective, and because of good software and software that is making a lot of those decisions and just simplifying the process, they're able to scale without the robotics. But it's coming. I guess it's just trying to figure out you know, which technologies are really going to take grip. So we're keeping an eye out and definitely spend time researching.
I don't know if you're aware, but Uber reported the first death by an auto car today.
That's right.
A woman was killed in Arizona. I'm going to go with a different direction because I'm fascinated by your company, as you well know. but let's talk about that last mile. That to me, someone once told me that's the most expensive part of any shipping, is that last mile. What do you do to help smaller businesses reduce that cost of the smaller mile, of that last mile?
Yeah, so I guess so I know that UPS through Mail Innovations, FedEx with some of their services, DHL, Ecom. It's really interesting to see how a lot of the major shipping carriers are coming out with different methods and ways in which you can reduce the cost on last mile. What we've done is we've essentially implemented a system that's going to massively reduce your cost in terms of fulfilling orders and shipping them, because the software ShipHero figures out based on when the customer ordered where the product has got to go to, and you know, figures out based on time when the order has got to be there. We will figure out the cheapest way to get that order there to that customer on time. So that reduces the cost. And then from a last mile perspective, I guess the same rules apply for any shipment, but especially last mile, and for the shipping carrier to be as efficient and as fast as possible. If it's a domestic order, making sure that the address is validated, that the requirements for the shipping carrier are met, and we have those safeguards built in when you fulfill the order. And then if you're doing international, which is something that more and more customers are doing, because obviously the world is getting smaller, we have a, it used to be a process where if you were shipping internationally, you had to create all of your export documents and, you know, all of these extra documents, the CN22s, obviously for customs. And then the customs would inspect that, and you know, you could have an order that shipped to a country, but it was on hold for it was in customs for 4 months. So we generate all of that information electronically and process that and send that to the shipping carriers. So the shipping carriers themselves, the DHLs, the FedExes, the UPSs, they've done an incredible amount in terms of making shipping easier for customers. And what we're doing is we're adding on top of that the ability to allow software to figure out which carrier and which method and what needs to be sent and do all that automatically. So all you have to do is put the items in a box, make sure it's packed, and print the shipping label, and everything else is taken care of.
We're talking with Nicholas Daniel Richards. He is co-founder of ShipHero. Dan, we're running out of time. Do you want one more question?
Well, I'd love to have one more question, but I couldn't do just one question with him. But we'll have to have him back sometime, because it's been a fascinating interview, and we're up against the clock. So, Nicholas, thank you for being with us and taking my questions, and it was a pleasure having you with us.
It's been a pleasure. I'm glad to bore you both again.
You really know your business. You really know your business, and I think your company really can help small business. Thank you so much, Nicholas Daniel Richards. A link to his website will be on recalculating.biz tonight, where you can hear this program and every other program that Dan and I have done in the past and in the future. Thank you so much for joining us.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz. I want to tell you about Bob Bethel. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. Bob Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. Dan Perkins with your featured book.
Dan, our next guest is Sean Worthington. He has written a book, Beyond Bitcoin, The Future of Digital Currency. I won't say anything more, because he will give us a great insight into the future. Sean, welcome to the program. But because Dan is our real expert on all this, I'm going to turn the whole thing over to him.
Thank you for joining us. I'm fascinated with the Bitcoin. I'm a registered investment advisor and have been for 44 years actively managing money. And I also write commentary, and I recently wrote a commentary when Bitcoins were at 19,000 on Newsmax, being very concerned about reading that people were mortgaging their homes to buy Bitcoins and putting them in their IRAs at 19,000. And what is it now, about 8,000?
Yeah, about 8,000.
Yeah. So tell me, what do you think happened here? Was it another tulip bulb mania or something else happening?
Yes, it was a tulip bulb. Basically, when Bitcoin started, the only people that were interested in it were libertarians who wanted to not use the Federal Reserve type money, the government money, and who wanted to buy and sell things privately. And then companies started using it who wanted to buy things, like in Venezuela, they could buy $1 million worth of oil using Bitcoin and get around the tariffs that the Venezuelan government put on the dollar. But then people who bought it noticed that the Bitcoins were going up in value. So they could just let it sit there and it would go up. And other people took note of that. And the next thing you know, all of these young punks, I guess you could call them, started buying it and advancing themselves as investors. And of course, they started using their credit cards to buy it, and they started mortgaging off of their houses to buy it, and using the family fortunes to get it. And that caused it to have a bubble. It really was a mania, and that bubble has popped, and now we see it going down, and it's pretty much a classical bubble shape of, as far as the price line goes.
Sean, let's take a moment just to go back and have the audience, you tell the audience about yourself and your background, and then what caused you to write this book about Bitcoins and digital currency.
Sure, I teach computer science and information systems in a community college here in Northern California, Butte College, and I've done that for about 20 years. And I was working on a PhD in computer information systems when I recognized that monetary systems are in fact information systems, that money plays the role of data, and that if we could take all of the rules that apply to databases, we can apply those to monetary systems and we can create a perfect monetary system. That's what I did. I created a new type of data structure to run the whole thing, which is an indestructible global cloud system of counterfeit detection. And I also created CloudCoin, which is a coin in which, instead of having the person need to create an account like you do with the blockchain, instead all of the money has accounts, so you just trade the money, and the money themselves logs in.
What was fascinating to me about the evolution of the Bitcoin is that when I wrote about this, if you're using it as, quote, currency,
mm-hmm.
Almost every government in the world that issues its local currency backs it, generally speaking, by the full faith and credit of the government and their potential ability to honor the currency. Now, mm-hmm. currency is traded in the currency markets, but there was really nothing behind the Bitcoin. There wasn't a government. There wasn't gold or silver reserves. There was nothing there. And so...
Yes.
I was amazed to see how fast it ran up to 19,000, and not surprised how fast it came down, because it's like the children's story you might have written to your children about the emperor had no clothes. When people began to realize that there wasn't a lot behind this, they decided that its value was probably too high. So tell us about your book and where do you think digital currencies are going, if anywhere?
Well, my big revelation, a realization, has been that what makes money money is not that it's backed by anything. In fact, because it's an information system, its job is to track our work. So if I do a bunch of work and create a bunch of value for society, I should be able to exchange that for dollars or some kind of coins or some kind of money, and then be able to turn around and get some value out. And other people who did not create any value should not be able to get any money out. And the people that do create value should. And so the whole money system is all about tracking who did what and making sure that they get their due. And that the only thing that a good money system has to do is do that, exactly that, help us to economize, help us to figure out what kind of job we're going to work at, and let us know that when we work, we actually get rewarded for it. And it doesn't matter about governments or backing by gold, because it's not the gold or the silver or the paper or the hard drives that it's written on that matter. It's the data that's written on the coin or the paper or the hard drive. So the monetary system is the data. Bitcoin was the first one to be able to solve what's called the physical integrity problem of digital money, and that is, how do you stop somebody from counterfeiting a digital item? They can just copy and paste it a million times. They were able to stop counterfeiting, but it's just the first. Digital currency is the future. We're now realizing that money is not just gold or silver or paper or the trust of a government. It is an information system, and its value comes from its ability to be good data.
Sean, there are some people who have looked at the digital currency, and these are not my words. I've read this. They call it a Ponzi scheme,
mm-hmm.
because the opportunity is built on somebody else buying and expanding the marketplace. And when we had the Bitcoin at 19,000, everybody couldn't get enough of it. But when it started to fall, everybody wanted to get out of it. So
yeah,
because there was nothing behind it. I mean, I feel for the people who bought it at 19,000, and I guess, did it get as low as almost under $7,000 in the last month or so?
I think so, very close to that, yes.
Yeah. So people at that point in time had lost a huge sum of money. And the realization that they lost money, but they really don't know why they lost money. So why do you think they lost money? Why do you think it went from 19,000 to 7?
It's because of the Federal Reserve. And so we have a system right now in which is an information system. Our Federal Reserve system creates these dollars, and they create them with the help of the government, and the government is able to borrow. And the banking system and the federal government basically hack our monetary system, and they extract value from it, and they issue new money whenever somebody borrows. And so this causes there to be booms and busts and illogical decisions being made. And the Federal Reserve caused the Bitcoin bubble, because it's not just Bitcoin, it's that people can borrow money in order to, and when I say borrow, they are able to basically print dollars out of thin air from their houses and from their credit cards in order to put that into Bitcoin. That's what caused the bubble, not necessarily that Bitcoin was, a bad thing.
So the last report I saw, and I'll admit to you, Sean, it may be a couple of months away since I saw it, but I think there were maybe 20 to 28 different digital coins.
Oh, there's 15,000 of them. I mean, 1,500 of them.
1,500 of them, but are they all actively traded?
Well, to certain degrees. And so Bitcoin uses the blockchain. The blockchain is a algorithm that is open to the public, where anybody can see it and anybody can copy it and paste it. They can change the name of it. They can market it, and they can they've been making a heck of a lot of money doing that. And so there's a lot of what I might call scam coins, or just coins that really have no right to exist because they're the same thing as Bitcoin. And so and that also means that there's no reason for Bitcoin to be worth as much as it is, because why would you pay that much for a coin when you just switch to another coin that's the same thing,
right,
and much cheaper?
So is the correction done in Bitcoin, or do you think it has further to go?
Well, I think that it's got further to go, and I think that it's going to drop down to 3,000, and that might even kill the currency, because the currency relies on these miners making money. They cost a lot of electricity. They have to spend a lot of money in hardware and also trying to cool their servers off. And so I think that we could actually see the price of Bitcoin drop below the cost of making new Bitcoins. And since the whole system requires new Bitcoins to be counterfeited or made by these miners, I could even conceive that Bitcoin could crash and disappear.
Yeah.
And I think that, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. So, Sean, I want to go back to our listeners, small business people.
Sure.
Has the crash in Bitcoin slowed the progression of the use of Bitcoins? And should our listeners, small business people, should they be considering taking Bitcoin in their businesses or waiting a while?
No way should they take Bitcoin. Bitcoin is the first technology, and now we have second movers. We have technologies that come and solve all of Bitcoin's problems. Bitcoin takes hours to transact. The problem with Bitcoin was that it was too successful. People started using it, and the more people started using it, the slower it got because it can only handle 7 transactions per second. And when people, when it became so slow, people didn't want to use it anymore, and we saw all of these companies that took Bitcoin stopped. They stopped taking it. And so Bitcoin, I believe, is on its deathbed. It is the first technology, but it is definitely not the last, and it's not the best. And why would you choose Bitcoin when there's so many other alternatives out there that are much better?
So if I could ask you a question about your own words, if it's not the best, then what do you think is the author of this book? And give us the name, the title of your book again, please, Sean.
It's called Beyond Bitcoin, The Future of Digital Currency.
And where can they buy it?
They can get it at Amazon.com, but they can also get it for free if they go to digitalfrontiernews.com and sign up for the newsletter. Then they can also get 5 free cloud coins.
Wow. So if Bitcoin is a dying coin, who's the new king of the hill?
Well, there is this battle that goes on, and what happened is that after Bitcoin fell, everybody turned to Ethereum, but Ethereum had something called the CryptoKitties game that was on it, and that crashed it. So then people started turning to other things, and the market's trying to find what is going to be the next coin. We have a model of what we think makes a good coin, and it has to do with the same kind of standards that we apply to databases, physical integrity and logical integrity. We're concerned about, number one, can somebody just turn off the server and it stops working? Can somebody counterfeit it? Can it be lost permanently? Privacy, do people have to have accounts? Can they trade it without accounts? And a whole bunch of other items that we have. And, you know, of course, we've developed Cloudcoin, which we believe is the perfect one that nobody can compared to, that nobody can do better than.
And the cloud coin, how quickly can you trade those?
So those are scalable, meaning the more people that use it, it doesn't slow everything down. And in theory, we can handle the entire global population using it.
Wow.
And as far as the time goes, the time is usually less than a second.
Do you think that a lot of the 1,500 coins that you said are out there, some of them not being real, some of them being bogus, what role did some of the nefarious governments have in manipulating that market, do you think?
Well, I don't have any evidence to show that they've been manipulating the market, although it's possible. But we have seen that China and Venezuela have created their own coins. They've just taken the whole blockchain, copy and pasted, and created their own coins. And the problem with the blockchain in general is that it tracks every single transaction that ever happens, and that means that this database gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and the governments can create what I call blockchain socialism. And this is where they assign everybody an account. They now know how much money you have. They know who you're trading with. And they can even redistribute wealth, and they can track where you are, possibly, and where you've been using the GPS technology, and they can track what you literally bought, restaurants that you've gone to. And so that kind of system is something that China and Venezuela are looking at, and I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, you have, because what you've created is another question, and that is with the ability to capture information, and as you started this interview, you talked about why it was invented, because people wanted to do private transactions. It appears, if I'm understanding you correctly, Sean, is that privacy that they thought they might have had at once is no longer there.
That's right, because it turns out that they're using that the blockchain is pseudo-anonymous, and that means that they've got this account that represents you, and if somebody can connect that account to you by maybe coming into your house and grabbing your computer or stealing your cell phone or something, then they know exactly how much money you have and everything that you've done. And so that is, you know, that defeats the entire purpose of it.
So if
and there's
if
quantum
we could,
computers, by the way, which
okay,
which can crack that, and then we're all in, and then that's the end of that.
Yeah. So let's try and see if we can give our listeners some self help here. Given the volatility of the what appears to be at least Bitcoin and perhaps some of the other coins, what would you be saying to our small business people? We talked about staying away from it from the standpoint of using it in your business. What about investment opportunities? Do you think they should stay away from that for a while too?
Well, I think that we've just come out of a bubble, and this bubble is similar to the bubble that happened during the housing market. And, you know, so there's going to be prices that are going to be below what they should be. And so, in fact, if you wanted to buy now and sell in 2 years, it's probably, you know, I think we still have some down slope to go, but pretty soon it will be an opportunity. And digital currencies really are something that are very beneficial and good, and I think that they're going to go up in value. And so I think that if you're investing for the long term, I think it's a good investment. But as far as getting rich quick and making 10 times the money in the next month or something, forget about that.
They certainly advertise the hell out of it, that. So if you wanted to play digital currency, we're not going to call Bitcoin, you have grave concerns that the Bitcoin could even survive because of multiple reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So if I was going to play, do you know, and maybe you don't, and that's okay, but if you don't know, if there's any, are there any mutual funds that people could buy that invest in coins, Bitcoins? And if not, is there on your website, do you list some of the safer ones to buy?
Yes, the number one group that I like is DFN, which is DigitalFrontierNews.com. Of course, we are, they have basically purchased lots of our coins. And so, you know, they believe in us, and we certainly believe in them and their decision-making as well. But they have a very good track record of investing in digital currencies.
So you said they buy your cloud coin?
Yes, they do.
So as a creator of a cloud coin,
mm-hmm,
of the cloud coin, how do you and your people make money?
Well, we basically created this currency a year and a half ago, and then we built this data structure around it, and then we're building all the software around that. And then we spend the coin into money, or we spend it into existence. And so we have a bunch of system administrators and programmers who are paid in CloudCoin. And then if those people, after they earn their CloudCoins, they can turn around and sell them. And so that's how they can earn dollars if they want to, or they can don't even have to get dollars. They can just take their CloudCoins and spend them on anybody that'll take them.
So, but how do you, as the inventor or the developer of the cloud coin, how do you make money?
Well, I should say that we literally make money. And when you literally make money and it's good money, then you just spend it. And so, I don't know if that answers your question, but
no,
cloud
I'm just
coin
thinking
is
that,
money.
Okay, well, I guess what I'm not asking the question the right way. So let me try again. Do you have a company that makes the cloud coin?
No, if we had a company or any kind of central thing that could be attacked, then that would give us a vulnerability, and we would probably be gone very quickly. So we have to make it so that if anybody dies or if any component of the organization drops, that the whole thing keeps going.
So people cannot bring you dollars. They can't wire you money through the Federal Reserve to buy the cloud coins.
They can. And if they were to go to online, just type in buy cloud coins, they can find people that are selling them.
So you as the company that invented the cloud coin, do not make a market in the cloud coin. It's the people who own the cloud coin who make the market.
Yes. So normally with these digital currencies, they have something called an ICO, initial coin offering, and they just sell all their coins. And we don't do that because, number one, we don't need any money as investment, because why would we need money investment if we're actually making money? And so we just make the money, we spend it, and we invest our own money. And then if somebody wants to sell that, then they can, but they have to do that on their own. There's no security. We're not a security. If the money, the value goes down, it's not my fault or anybody else's fault, and then
it's just the
in charge of. Yes.
Right.
Can I jump in here? Because I'm
sure.
Terribly confused. I'm sorry. That's why I turned it over to you. But I have to tell you, Sean. I'm sitting here, and I happen to have all but a dissertation in history, PhD dissertation. And, I've gone through the gold standard, the silver standard. In fact, last week, when I had to take out my safety deposit box because the branch was closing, I found I had silver certificates from 1928.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm hearing you correct, you're saying that this whole industry is based on the fact that you and other people are creating these, quote, electronic coins, and people are buying them based on the fact that they're simply digital numbers and creating value, and they're buying and selling it, much like in the 16th century. In Holland, we had the tulip speculation. Am I hearing this correctly?
No, because you're assuming that everybody that's in it is making investments. And it's been true that in the past year and even 2 years, there's been a crazy amount of investors that have came into this industry and have bought up a bunch of Bitcoins with the idea that they're going to get rich quickly. And then, of course, they found out that that wasn't going to happen. But really, the value of a digital currency is it allows you to trade anywhere in the world day and night without any bank fees, without any taxes or tariffs, and you can do it with 100% privacy or at least pseudo-privacy. And so that's what makes it valuable. And that's you can't do that with gold and silver. You can't do that even with the American dollar. So it's a big deal.
It's a big deal, but it seemed to me, somehow or other, if it looks so good that it can't be true, it isn't true. I'm sorry, you're talking now to a skeptic. Dan is more the explorer of ideas. But I'm sitting here. Now, I know that Bitcoin and others have been used in ransom demands and other things, but the value of anything is what somebody will give you in return for it. And that's the basis of currency. And I'm just sitting here just like perplexed, okay? And
well, imagine this, if I told you this. If I said there's two money supplies, one is made by Canada, the other one's made by Mexico. Mexico prints up money all the time and spends it. Canada has a system in which they don't print up money ever, or at least they do it very slowly. You probably would want to go with Canada because you understand that adding new money into the system is bad for you because it's going to cause the supply to go up and the value of it's going to go down. We have created a currency in which there's no counterfeits. That means that there's no new money that are created. Bitcoin is similar, where it's very slow.
Sean, but wait a second. You've created it. Someone out on the West Coast.
So money has to be created by somebody. This is the first money to be created by a computer scientist. and not a.
But
not
you're
kind of
you're in effect saying you're taking from the government's ability to create money, and you're saying that now, and I could go out with Dan and find a creative programmer and create a small business coin.
Well, let's suppose that you were a government and that you wanted to have the best currency that is possible. We're actually in talks with major governments, and we will create their digital currency. And so if a major government is willing to hire me and pay me millions of dollars to create a currency for their nation, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with me creating a currency for you?
Well, I'm not as smart as you in that respect. I just I'm having a hard time getting my mind around this, but I'll turn it back to Dan. I just had to drop in my two cents because I was
listening. Let me see if I can help you a little bit, Don, because there's a very important element here that Sean pointed out, but maybe we didn't emphasize it enough. Dan Perkins and Don Mozilla decide they want to create a small business Bitcoin, and we create 3 million coins.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we create. We don't create anything more. The difference mm-hmm. between us and the United States government or any other government around the world is that they print money. They keep devaluing the currency by printing more and more money. And what Sean is saying is that when a Bitcoin is originally sold, the initial coin offering, if they create 3 million, 30 million, 300 million, that's all they're going to create. And so the market then trades those coins based on a scarcity and need factor, unlike the government, which now has reported last week $21 trillion of debt that they have created, in essence, currency for to fund the debts that we have, and they've devalued dramatically the value of our currency. What Sean is saying is that the Bitcoin people make X number of coins, and that's it. So the world supply will be whatever they bring out at their initial coin offering. That's the fundamental, one of the fundamental differences between Bitcoins and government currency. The government owns the printing press. But once the first initial coin offering are made, that's it.
And that is a hack. And so we have an information system, and the government, with the Federal Reserve, the banking system, have formed a, it's kind of like church and state, except it's bank and state, and the agreement is that the banks are going to be able to print up all the money that they want, and the government, in return, is going to be able to borrow all they want. And so by creating this alliance, they're able to, the government can come in and get money to pay for all these programs, and the including wars, and the banks can come in and make a lot of money on their loans, which usually are home loans, because that's the safest. And so it causes the housing market to go nuts and for us to make illogical decisions. If we could have a money that was not controlled by the banks and the government, and it was a good money that tracked everybody's work, then that would greatly benefit our society.
Yeah. Don, I think we're out of time.
Yes, we are. It's absolutely fascinating. Sean, again, your books and where people can reach you.
So if they can go to digitalfrontiernews.com, sign up for the newsletter, they'll get the book for free as well as 5 free cloud coins to try out.
Well, it's been a fascinating time with you. We've been talking with Sean Worthington. You just heard about his book and the future of currency, electronic currency. I'm still getting my head around it, but it's been fascinating, and I think we have to have him back again sometime. A link to his website will be on recalculating.biz tonight, where you can hear this program and every other program Dan and I have done in the past. Thank you so much, Sean, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.